but to build these things, it's, you know, you're into a, you know, $40-50 million category. So he really wants to salvage not only the first booster, but eventually be, of course, done the yeah, they have to get down to zero. So, you know, put himself down. Rockets go up and then they go straight up to us, but they're really going up, and then they always go east or west so they can get into orbit. And so, you know, he's flying like almost parallel to the ground. So he's got to do a 180 with nitrogen jets, launch, ignite three of the engines to slow himself down from 4,000 miles per hour to, you know, once he gets slowed down and starts coming down, then he's got another burn. So that's the second burn. And then the final burn is when they get close to the drone ship. And like what you said, Joe, you know, they gotta have enough fuel on board to do that, and then shut itself down and hope they don't blow up, you know, by falling over. But he keeps getting close. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we'll pick up Joey's second question in a second. I guess I was thinking if he puts the barge further downrange, I would think he doesn't have to slow down as much, but maybe he still does. He would also think some of the slowdown could be done with a drogue parachute instead of rocket power. But I can see there's too many things that can go wrong with that. So a few hundred miles downrange, he parks the barge, relights three of the engines to slow it down for 4,000 miles an hour, lets it drop vertically, and then relights a second gimbaled engine in order to actually do the landing. Thinking of reusing the second stage also. How about that? In some cases there's a third stage, but in some cases on a synchronous satellite, the third stage is an apogee kick motor, which never comes back into the atmosphere. So no recovery of that one, and there's nothing to recover per se. That's a one-time use rocket engine, I think. So these expensive engines, megabucks worth, he's able to recover those just in project. What's your second question, Joe, to B2LYY, K2LAW?
About the boost back, you were talking about the boost back, Dick.
What do you mean by boost back? Give me some words on that one, Paul.
You were right in what you were saying. You know, he's down, way down range. But, you know, the last time when he came back to Cape Canaveral, he launched 11 satellites all in one shot, you know. But it was only, 400 miles up or something. This thing, of course, has got to have enough fuel to get the satellite to 23,000 miles up. You're going to use a lot more fuel. Was able to, you know, have the initial boost back was, you know, closer to Florida, so he was able to do this whole operation and land it back on land. This time, you know, he's getting way downrange, pushing the satellite, you know, the second stage and the satellite, trying to get it to a geosynchronous orbit, so he's way downrange, and but he still has to do a boost back. Going 4,000 miles per hour in a forward direction, he has to slow that down to zero to start coming straight down. So that's what I mean by the boost back stage. He's got to slow down to zero. I mean, if you had enough fuel on board, I guess you could fly it all the way back to Florida if you want, but that's not the case. And the other thing is, in the future, he's going to be launching the Falcon Heavies. Let me drop it. Falcon Heavies are three Falcon 9s really bolted together. So you'll see three Falcon 9s, and then on top of that you'll have the you know, what we call the second stage, and on top of that you'll have the payload. His goal is to bring back all three stages. So let's say he's going to put up something into a geosynchronous orbit, and I know he's got a contract for the military coming up with one of these to take two of the two, let's call them the first stage, the two boosters that are going to separate, and he wants to land them back on land. And then the third one will be way downrange again, like this one's going to be. And he plans on taking the third one and landing onto a barge. And then this way, all three will be recovered. By the way, he experimented with parachutes in the beginning. He didn't like it. Didn't work out, like you said. Even so, the space shuttle, we had reusable boosters for the space shuttle. Those things used to come back on parachutes. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, those are the solid rocket boosters. Elon Musk, he's got some fancy ideas, innovative ideas. Had NASA been the only name in town of boosting rockets into space, I'm convinced they never would have even considered returning the boosters back to ground for reuse, the liquid-fueled boosters. I don't think NASA would have ever done that. Only Musk had a wild enough idea, and it looks like it's a darn good one. What's your second question, John? Here we go, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Individual RYY. Yeah, on the news tonight, I think I heard they say something about on Apollo 10, when it was going around the moon, it was on the, I guess apparently the far side of the moon out of terrestrial communications, that the astronauts experienced a strange type of squealing sound coming through their communication system. And I don't know why you hear about this like 40-something years later, but they still have never been able to identify what's apparently the sound, where it came from, or what they think was producing it. You ever heard anything about that? Back to you.
Yeah, I'm going to send it back to Paul in a minute. I haven't. But when you're on the backside of the moon and you're out of sight of planet Earth, the way the deep space network works, where the frequency of the downlink from whatever spacecraft we're talking about is determined by a lock with the uplink frequency from the ground. The ground is the real frequency master. Equipment on board the spacecraft is the slave. And so when the slave has no master talking to it, that voltage-controlled oscillator can go way off to one side, do funny things. The fact that your radio can do peculiar things when it has absolutely no signal to listen to, that doesn't strike me so strange. It's not a good design. I mean, the squelching circuit should be an audio squelch that cuts off the audio when you don't have a valid signal on the input. But, the UFO people are going to say, aha, somebody in the backside of the moon was talking to them. I doubt that very highly. So when it comes to this squealing signal on the backside of the moon on Apollo 10, I know Apollo 8 looped around the moon. I don't remember the Apollo 10 mission. So bring us up to speed on what Apollo 10 did, because I don't remember right now. And have you heard about this squealing signal, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the deck net.
Yeah, Apollo 10, that had, of course, three astronauts on board. And two of them eventually walked on the moon, Young and Cernan. Stafford, that was his last flight. And Young eventually walked on the moon. I think it was Apollo 15. And then Cernan eventually walked on the moon himself. He was the last man to walk on the moon. That was Apollo 17. But they needed Apollo 10. That was a prerequisite for Apollo 11. Very well organized with the way they did everything. Even so, they made some changes in the initial plans. They had Apollo 7 and it tested everything out in orbit. When I say everything, you know, the Apollo spacecraft itself, not the lunar module. And Apollo 9 really wasn't ready because the LEM wasn't ready yet. So what they said is, okay, well, what do we got to do for Apollo 8? And then they said, let's launch three people around the moon, do 10 orbits, and then bring them back. And that's what they did. So they knew that was good. But that, again, went all the way to the moon and all the way back without a LEM on board. Let me try. Now the LEM was ready. So what are we going to do with the LEM? Are we going to put it into orbit around the moon? No, let's put it around the Earth and test everything here. In case something goes wrong, we want to be in Earth orbit. So follow 9-9 went up with the LEM, and you know, and they, you know, went for the maneuvers just like they would you know, if they were going to the moon. You know, they took this Apollo spacecraft, maneuvered it, you know, did a 180 back toward the third stage, and you know, that's where the LEM was sitting, docked with it, and pulled it out of the fairing, and checked everything out, and they actually separated in orbit around the Earth from one another, and then redocked, did it again, made sure they could dock with one another properly. And once that was good, they said, okay, well, now we, you know, we're up to Apollo 9, let's do Apollo 10. Let's really make sure everything works. We'll take this thing to the moon. Again, we'll orbit the moon, and we'll do the exact same tracking and everything that Apollo 11 will do. And the only thing we're not going to do is fire the engines and then go down to the land on the moon. So they separated from the command module around the moon in the LEM, you know, two guys in the LEM and one guy in the command module, and they flew around, and they didn't, you know, they went out of sight from one another. They couldn't see each other, and they had to make sure the radars and everything worked to get back to each other, redock, and then come back home. And then it was, of course, time for Apollo 11. They did exactly the same thing as Apollo 10, except they landed. Back to you, Dave.
Paul, was Apollo 10 the one where the astronauts got quite close to the moon, stuck the thruster, created a very rapid spin, and if the astronaut didn't get control of that, that could have been game over? Was that Apollo 10 where that incident occurred, Paul? Go ahead.
Talking about the one where they were spinning rapidly, where they were going to pass out, is that the one you're talking about?
That's the one.
That was actually Gemini 11. You know, you had the Gemini project. That was, you know, you had two people in each spacecraft, hence the name Gemini, and they ran through countless tests from Gemini 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, and 12. So they had 10 flights in the Gemini program. Gemini, let me think. It had to be Gemini 9 or 8. No, it couldn't be 8. That was the ones where they rendezvoused. Probably 9 or 10. And Neil Armstrong was at the controls, and he had stopped it with him. And I'm trying to think. I think it was a thruster. Okay, they connected. They were trying to dock with the Agena spacecraft. They sent an Agena spacecraft up on another Titan rocket, another Atlas rocket, and Titan rocket sent the Gemini craft up. And after they docked with it, one of the thrusters got stuck open, but they didn't know it, so let me drop it. So they figured out the Agena target. That they started going even faster. You know, I think what happened was skating when they pulled their arms in, you know, they shortened the whole setup up, and I think they started going faster. 4 revolutions per minute, you know, close to the point where they're going to pass out. But Armstrong knew where the switches were and knew what to hit, and he must have hit the right one because he shut down that valve. And that thruster that was stuck open, and was it finally able to regain control by hitting the other thrusters to get themselves out of that yaw situation. That's probably one of the things, one of the reasons, out of many reasons why they picked Armstrong to land on the moon. I think getting out of that Gemini possible disaster. Then because of all the fuel he used up, they came back early on that Gemini flight. Back to you, Dick.
Are you fairly sure, Paul, that none of the Apollo spacecraft also ran run into a rapid spinning problem. Over to you, Paul.
They had a potential problem, of course, with 13 on the way back. You know, that's the one that, you know, was like temporarily marooned in space, of course. That gave them a problem because they were trying to keep everything straight going toward the Earth when they were finding the thrusters on the LEM to get back. You know, did it go spinning? No, it didn't spin. So I'm not sure. If it happened, I don't remember. Might be different.
Question for Paul. You got a turn?
Paul, on Apollo 10, what did they do with the lunar lander? Did they just dump that down into the moon? They didn't bring that back, right?
All the limbs, when they were done playing with, Apollo, the 10 was the first one that they brought to the moon, but Apollo 11, of course, landed. But after they went back up, they still had the limb, so they had to get rid of it. They all went back down to the moon. The only one that did not go back to the moon was Apollo 10. They sent that into solar orbit. John, the rest of them, they, you know, all the way to 17. After they were done with them, they crashed them back into the moon.
Paul, wasn't Apollo 13 the lifeboat that they brought as far back to Earth as possible? Because you didn't want to use the batteries on the command service module because you needed them for reentry. So wasn't the lunar module brought back toward Earth on Apollo 13? Over to you.
Yeah, then when they got into Earth orbit, they burnt it up. Yep. Yeah, that was their lifeboat. You know, so yeah, managed to utilize that. You know, they actually used that the landing part of the LEM to as a main rocket. Use the thrusters and everything to keep the attitude right. They didn't use anything in the Apollo until they got back. They had to shut down the fuel cells because there was no more oxygen. The oxygen tank blew up, or very low oxygen. So they needed to keep the batteries good. You know, they had to do things when they got to eventually come out of orbit. One of the things they had to do is they added a battery powder to ignite the pyrotechnics, including the parachutes. So, I mean, the people who built the LEM and Grumman on Long Island really saved the day on that one. Back to you, Doc.
Yeah, that wasn't properly illustrated in the movie Apollo 13. They made the Grumman engineer look like a not so nice guy. The truth was very different. One of the things that we discussed last week, flow wave structures, whether it be the directors that are part of a long Yagi, or whether it be the molecules that are in the glass, that are in your magnifying glass. And Wes was asking us why. And Roy gave me some more information on that. I thought about it some more. I realized that quite a bit of that flow wave characteristic I was taking for granted. There's more to it. And it all starts off with considering a transmission line and a Smith chart. Believe it or not, they're related. I'll show you what I mean. If I've got a 50 ohm transmission line, for instance, and I put a short circuit at the end of it, all the signal that goes down the line hits the short circuit. Any signal hitting a short circuit goes into a phase reversal, whether it's a mirror or a short circuit at the end of the coax cable. The signal reverses in polarity and reflects back toward the source. At the end of the transmission line is an open circuit. You don't get a phase reversal, but you still get 100% reflection. And the Smith chart will show you that. The outer perimeter of the Smith chart tells you the angle of reflection, and the short circuit on the way the person usually holds a Smith chart, the far left-hand side, is 0 ohms of resistive component loading your transmission line, and you can see that you get 180 degrees of phase reversal.
and the right hand side is open circuit, infinity, and you get 0 degrees of phase reversal and complete reflection. Now, what happens if you put a capacitor on the end of the transmission line? Let me drop it. If you start off with an extremely large capacitor at your operating frequency, its capacitive reactance will be essentially 0 ohms. You're really right back at the exact same point, the 0 ohm point on the far left-hand side of the Smith chart. Now, as you start allowing the capacitor to become smaller and smaller, which means the capacitive reactance at your operating frequency is getting bigger and bigger, you're now starting to walk around the perimeter of the Smith chart. The outer perimeter of the Smith chart represents, in the upper half of the Smith chart, it represents capacitors of different amounts of capacitive reactants. Let me drop.
One arm always on. Thank God for computers. That's the first one I mentioned.
Yeah, I thank you for that, Paul. And once again, if you're hearing signals that you don't think should be there, go to the reverse mode on your receiver. Listen to the 146.25 input, and whatever signal you hear, whatever signal strength, and whatever time you hear it, please go to Limark.org and please report it. And as this person is doing that, he's showing up on my map, so I know pretty much where he is. Thank goodness for NY2H. Lou built a beautiful system that tracks things like that. Okay, so I'm going around the perimeter of the Smith chart, starting on the lower left-hand corner, at the left-hand edge, and I'm starting to move clockwise as I use smaller and smaller capacitors. And the outer perimeter of the Smith chart will tell you how many degrees of phase lag you get from the capacitor as a load. So by putting capacitors on the end of a transmission line and setting them on a Smith chart, you know exactly what reflection angle you're going to get. A capacitor gives you a lagging phase of reflecting signal. Let me drop. Now, when I've got a director on a Yagi and the director is tuned high in frequency, that really means I'm transmitting a signal to it, so to speak, at a lower frequency than its resonance. Once again, it presents a capacitive reactance. But the capacitive reactance of your director is being excited by the signal coming into it. The director absorbs some of that signal and re-radiates it. Every director hears some signal coming into it. It starts moving with that signal, so to speak. It becomes excited by that signal and re-radiates it. But because it is tuned higher in frequency than the frequency it's going into it, because the signal going into it is lower than its resonance, it is a capacitive reactant. Your director is a capacitor. Therefore, when it re-radiates the signal, it re-radiates the signal with a phase delay. So the mechanism of the slow wave structure is each director hits the signal, re-radiates it with a phase delay, and it gives an additional phase delay from each one of the directors down that string as the signal gets absorbed and re-radiated. Now, when it comes to the molecules of a piece of glass, let me drop. Molecules are very small compared compared to the wavelength of the signal that's exciting them. Each individual molecule is being excited and re-radiated, but because it is too small to be resonant, it is re-radiating with a capacitive reactance. The signal it re-radiates has a phase delay. So you're getting a little bit of phase delay on each molecule that the signal is going through as it propagates through the glass. That's the reason why the glass has a velocity factor or index of refraction. They're very close to the phenomenon. The velocity factor through the glass might be 90% of what it is in free space. And that gives you a particular so-called refractive index. Let me drop. The signal hitting your glass, of your magnifying glass, at an angle, a portion of the signal hits the glass first, gets delayed earlier, and that's the usual diagram people draw shows the way the signal gets bent closer to the normal of the glass as you enter from air into the glass. The signal becomes closer to the normal angle of that edge of the glass. That's one way of looking at it, as a refractive index. I'd like to look at the glass as a slow wave structure. The signal going through the glass is slower in the glass than it is in free space, so that this planar wave hitting your magnifying glass, because the thickness of the magnifying glass in the center is greater, that amount of signal in the center is going to be delayed more than the signal near the perimeter of your magnifying glass. Can we drop? So if I take a planar signal coming into your magnifying glass, and I delay the signal in the center more than around the perimeter, that means the signal exiting the magnifying glass, the center has been more delayed, your planar signal going in is now a concave shaped signal as far as its phase front is concerned. Concave when you look back in the direction from where the signal came. Because of Huygens' principle where the signal always, the individual little wavelets of the signal, the microscopic sections of the signal will always propagate perpendicular to the local phase front, because that local phase front is now a concave shaped phase front. The signals that are all following that characteristic are now coming to a point downrange that you and I call the focal point. So the delay makes your planar phase front become concave. The Huygens principle means the little sections of that concave wave front re-emit a signal that now they all have a slightly different angle at which they're propagating, but they all come to a focal point because of that concave wave front. So there's a strong relationship in, let me drop, the way a transmission line behaves with a capacitive load, the way a director of a Yagi behaves, because each of the elements are tuned higher in frequency, therefore they re-emit a signal that's lower in the current. Through a capacitive load, they re-emit a signal that's delayed in phase. That's where the slow wave function is up, is coming. And the portion of the signal coming down your boom of your Yagi gets the maximum amount of delay, very similar to what happens with the center of your magnifying glass. Let me drop. The portion of the signal that's further away from your boom coming down the signal is like the perimeter of the magnifying glass. It doesn't get delayed as much. So therefore, once again, within your Yagi, that planar wavefront of that signal coming in from infinity, as it goes down the boom of the Yagi, gets delayed more close to the boom than away from the boom. The signal is being converted into a concave wave front. That concave wave front is now focusing the signal towards the driven element. So your director strength is really very similar to a magnifying glass. It is a magnifying glass in the way it acts with that signal, and that signal by your long director string is being focused on the driven element. Another piece of evidence that goes along this characteristic, let me drop, is that if you build a Yagi of a certain length and you get a certain amount of gain, decide you want to build a Yagi with higher gain. Common sense would say, okay, I add some extra length to the front of the boom and I put some more directors out there. Do that and you don't really get the performance you think you're going to get. You didn't realize it, but what you're doing is you're now focusing at a point that's in front of the driven element. When you now start comparing the design of longer and longer boom Yagis with more and more directors, you'll find out that all of the directors are made a little bit shorter on the long boom Yagi compared to the short boom Yagi. You're really buying, you're really building a magnifying glass with a longer focal length. You're adjusting in the direction of a little bit less phase delay on the way each director behaves in the absorption and re-radiation. You're making a longer focal length magnifying glass when you build a longer boom Yagi, and you make all the directors a little bit shorter. So for each length of boom of Yagi, let me drop. There's a nearly ideal number of directors you put there with a certain spacing between them, but there's an ideal length of each of the directors in order to get the right focal length. And to get maximum gain out of the Yagi, they sometimes have length versus position along the boom, which has the so-called Coke bottle shape when you graph it. So what you're really building is a structure, it's the equivalent of multiple lenses, so to speak. You're really building a structure that has what the Yagi people will call a particular velocity profile. In other words, the local velocity factor for each location along the boom of the Yagi is an ideal local velocity that gives you the best focusing of the overall Yagi. When you see that plotted, all your directors are not the same length. So the most ideal Yagi, let me drop. The most ideal Yagi for long Yagis have slightly different element lengths for each director, slightly different element spacings for each director, in order to create this most desirable velocity profile along the boom that gives you the greatest amount of focusing. When you put it all together, let me show you what the magic of that can do. The Yagi that I'm most familiar with, where I spent probably 1,000 hours tuning the damn thing in my backyard on a ratiometry antenna range, is the 19-element insulated Yagi for 432. Okay? When that thing is really working well, all of your directors on that boom are around 11 inches long, 11 or 12 inches, in that order. So common sense would lead you to believe, okay, that whole director string of that Yagi is going to gather energy from an 11-inch diameter of space. Good common sense. That's not what it's doing. The effective capture area of that antenna is a circle that is 5.5 feet in diameter. That's kind of magic. Each of the directors are only 1 foot long, and yet that whole director string, let me think now, you got two reflectors, one driven element, 19, 18, 17, 16, you got 15 directors out in front. Those 15 directors that are all roughly 1 foot long are gathering energy from a 5.5 foot diameter of space. If your eyes operated at 432 megahertz, and you look down the boom of that Yagi while it's operating, you would see a black hole in space, 5.5 feet in diameter. All the signal coming down the front of that Yagi, that's in that 5.5 foot diameter, the vast majority of it all gets focused down to that driven element. It goes down the feed line, let me drop. And it eventually moves the signal strength meter on your receiver. As you can see, a Yagi is a beautiful skeleton structure. It's the minimum amount of material out in space. It's acting like a 5 or 6 foot diameter parabolic dish, 100% efficiency parabolic dish. A 6 foot diameter parabolic dish would have one hell of a big wind load. Little bitty directors, 3/16 of an inch in diameter, 1 foot long, 16 of them on that Yagi, have very little wind load. Probably 1% or 2% of the wind load of a 6 foot diameter dish. And yet it is capturing radio signal as if it was a 6 foot diameter dish with near 100% efficiency. Get a lot of bang for the money out of a well-tuned Yagi. Your strong feeling for why I believed that the most ideal antenna you hang on the front end of a RFID reader at 900 megs is a three-element Yagi, because by the FCC rules, you're allowed to use an antenna as high as 6.0 dB of gain of isotropic. A three-element Yagi can give you as much as 6.2 dB of gain. So the 6 dB of gain is an easily tunable position, and if you use the right procedure, so you now get extremely low standing wave ratio over that 902 to 928 meg region. You've now got a very high performance, high gain, very low wind resistance, so to speak, although it doesn't matter on a handheld object. That thing hanging out there in front is still pretty massive compared to the rest of the handheld computers, so to speak. So there are people who say, why is that great big black thing out in front? Well, that's the magic that gives you 24 foot of range out of that RFID reader. To listen to a thoroughly passive tag from 24 feet away, you're listening to the echo of that signal from 24 feet away. The signal comes back at you at around minus 85 or minus 90 dBm. You can read the 96-bit code that's on that tag, and there's no local power supply. Boy, that whole system gives you a lot of bang for the money. And so you put one of those RFID tags on every one of the boxes of stuff that you're storing in your warehouse. And now because somebody has put the box in the wrong place in the warehouse, and you can't find it, it's got perishable material, and you take the right RFID reader, tell it, I'm looking for tag number 45, and you go walking up and down the aisles, waving this reader around, and when it finds the tag with that serial number on it, it lets you know that you're pointing at it right now, it tells you the range, and you can go and get that box. And because the RFID tag can be on the third box on the back of the shelf, where there are things in front of it, you can't even see that box. You wouldn't be able to read the barcode on that box, but you can read that RFID tag. There's a lot of magic in that whole system. And a well-designed RFID reader, when you've got a pallet full of equipment that's walking through a dock door at your warehouse, it's being moved by a forklift truck. Let me drop. A well-designed reader can read a couple of hundred of those tags per second as they walk through that dock door, which has got these RFID antennas around the perimeter of that dock door. Boy, that's a lot of information flowing in a hurry through that kind of a system when it's really humming. So RFID has got a lot of magic to it. It's got a couple of disadvantages. You put that RFID tag behind a bottle of soda because water is so absorptive. The amount of signal that gets to your tag that's on the backside of that bottle of soda is so darn small that your read range that used to be 24 feet, it may have gone down to 3 feet, if you know what I mean, because of the water absorption. There's a way around that, but it's not easy. So each of these objects, barcode is by far the cheapest, but you only get 12 bits of information out of it. The RFID tag, in the natural sense, has got 96 bits, and you can buy super ones that have got a hell of a lot more bits than that, and you can rewrite those bits in the field. There's kinds of RFID tags where, as your piece of shipped equipment goes to 3 or 4 different ports and being shipped from Southeast Asia to the United States, as your piece of equipment stops at each one of those ports, the guy operating the RFID reader in that port can add information to the reprogrammable portion of that tag, where by the time that piece of equipment gets to you in New York, you've now got a complete story of all the places it went, how long it went there, how long it was there, what day it arrived, what day it left. There's a 96-bit story that you could, in theory, put on that tag as it goes across the world coming to you. So, and those tags, in theory, right now, they're around 25 cents apiece. 96 bits of information for 25 cents on a thoroughly passive device that has no local battery. There's a lot of magic for that. So, anybody got any further questions or comments on all of the above about slow wave structures, focusing radio signals? Give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, but I got one of your RFID readers, because you said you've been talking about that.
You said you've got one of mine. What does that mean? My brand name? How did you get your hands on it? Over to you, Joe.
No, you misunderstood me. I have a question related to what you're talking about, not the slow wave structure. Here you go, three in a row. What is the sensitivity
receivers in those units? I know they're operating on wideband. What's the receiver sensitivity? What's the noise floor, apparent noise floor of the device? And number three, have you ever done a test to see if the noise floor gets raised by you trying to interrogate something that's not there, like 14 away from a tag where you're not going to get a response back from a tag? You ever make those kind of measurements? Back to you.
Yeah, to some degree, we've done some of that work, Joe. First of all, the tag is a zero IF, the interrogator is a zero IF system. The frequency it transmits to the tag, the received signal coming back from the tag, is the identical frequency to the nearest hertz, so to speak, as long as you're not moving, creating some Doppler shift. A zero IF system, the noise equivalent bandwidth, is strictly a function of the low-pass filter that you use on the zero IF. I don't know the exact number, but if I had to make a guess, I would guess that that low-pass filter has something in the vicinity of 50 kilohertz of video bandwidth. So the noise equivalent bandwidth of that zero IF homodyne receiver is around 50 kilohertz. For you and I to make a real 900 meg receiver by doing it with super heterodyne, when you've got an IF frequency where it's only 50 kilohertz of bandwidth in the IF, that would be fairly difficult. By way of that homodyne zero IF type system, that happens fairly easily. The sensitivity of that receiver is in the vicinity of minus 90 dBm. Minus 90 dBm will give you around 12 or 14 dB of signal-to-noise ratio. That implies that the noise floor is in the vicinity of minus 102, minus 104. In that region is the noise floor of the receiver. In order to get a good low noise floor, you'd like to be using mixers in the front end. It's a mixer front end system, usually with no IF, with no RF amplifier. Let me drop. You'd like to be using mixers that have got fairly low insertion loss, being fed the right amount of local oscillator signal. And usually it's an I and Q mixer, a pair of mixers in the front end, giving you a so-called a vector demodulator. You could say there's really two zero IF receivers in there, one measuring the in phase and one measuring the quadrature phase with those two mixers on those two zero IF systems. And then you digitize the I and the Q signal in the IF, and the computer does all the magic on the rest of it to demodulate those pulses coming back from the tag. The tag gives you pulses of either amplitude or phase modulation, mostly amplitude. So around minus 90 or so dBm is the approximate sensitivity. You're transmitting a signal of 1 watt reel into a 6 dB gain antenna. 1 watt is plus 30 dBm. 6 dB of gain is plus 6. So your effective radiated power of the reader is plus 36. Your receiver sensitivity is close to minus 90 with a 6 dB gain antenna. So as you can tell, you've got between plus 36 and, let me call it, minus 96 if I include antenna gain. You've got a good number. You've got, almost 120, 125 dB of power spread between transmit signal and receive signal that you can respond to. That's where the 24 foot of range is coming from. The tag itself, let me drop it. The tag does a reception and re-radiation that gets modulated, and the tag is going to give you of the signal the tag absorbs, it's a dipole, and the signal it re-radiates, the signal it re-radiates is around 10 dB down. So you got 10 dB of loss in the tag, and the rest of the loss is the free space loss between your reader and the tag, and then from the tag, free space loss back to your reader. You've got something like 125 dB of power spread in that path that reader can accommodate. That gives you some rough numbers as to how that system works, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet, and we've got only 1 or 2 minutes left.
Has anybody else out there been able to duplicate your design as far as, with the antenna and electronics and so forth to be able to accomplish the same thing, or have you pretty much got it just sewed up?
When it comes to the electronics that does the transmitting and receiving, lots of people can do that. When it comes to to that particular antenna design. I think the client I was associated with, I think that's unique. To my knowledge, nobody else has an antenna of anywhere near that amount of gain Viswar combination. So the antenna is where that separated the men from the boys, if you know what I mean. The very first time that that system was demonstrated was at a Chicago show of industrial products, and the main competing company had a reader that could read at 6 feet, and he thought he had a real good design. He got a very expensive ceramic antenna with circular polarization and everything. He could read a tag at 6 feet. And our guy demonstrated reading the tag at 24 feet. The engineer from that opposing company sitting in the audience said, "That's a bunch of bull." He was positive a trick was being committed, that some kind of lie was taking place. He spent the next 4 days of that show, every single hour of every day, studying that product, trying to figure out what the hell was going on. Where was all that extra range coming from? If 6 feet had gone to 8 feet, he would have said, yeah, they got a little bit more sensitive receiver. When 6 feet goes to a doubling, in other words, 6 feet to 12 is 6 dB of loss one way, 12 feet to 24 is another 6 dB, so there's 12 dB of loss forward, 12 dB of loss, there's 24 dB of difference in performance. There's a bunch of ways I can explain where all that came from. He was positive somebody was lying somewhere. Mother Nature had really done some kind of a trick on him. It drove him up the wall. And our guy who was doing that demonstration told me that's the most fun he's ever had.
Repeater, time out.
Okay, we're being cut off. That was technet number 1589. Base report number 188. John, over to you for any final comments. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yep, great time. I'd like to thank everybody for joining the net and for the questions that were sent in. And those, well, we'll be back here next Sunday. At same time, same repeater. Good night, Dick. Good night, Paul. Everyone on the net.
WS2N. Hey, Paul, what do we got to look forward to next week? What are you going to wow us with next week, Paul?
I'm on HT, Dick. Negative copy.
We're hearing your HT. A little bit noisy. But we'll be looking forward to hearing the space report for next week. Back to you, Paul, for anything else.
Yes. 189.
Okay, that was 188 this week. 189 coming next week. Bye-bye, you all. And keep all those electrons flowing in your antennas, all those magnetic fields going out there into space that you radiate. There are 5,000 kinds of antennas. Your job is to find the one that's the best one for you. Bye-bye, you all. K2RIW.
WGB clear.
thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system.
That's the opening of the window.